high heading for 90. Right now, wind from the southwest at 18, 77 degrees for the sunny sky as we come up on 8:10. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. Support for the Morning Show also comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're taking to the open road today, courtesy of a talented writer by the name of Finn Murphy, who also happens to be a professional truck driver. He's been a trucker for more than 30 years, chiefly in the business known as long-haul moving, which involves moving somebody from one part of the country to another, often over the course of thousands of miles. And over the course of these years, he has had some very, very interesting and intriguing experiences. And he also has some very interesting insights into what it's like to be a trucker on the open road. His book is called The Long Haul, A Trucker's Tales of Life on the Road, published by W.W. Norton. I want you to explain something right off the bat, because I think it's important for us to understand this facet of your story, and it is a sort of predominant theme in your book. The very first sentence of chapter one says, "I've lived a good part of my life in an odd netherworld." And by that, I think you are referring to being, in a sense, a bit out of your element. Explain further what you mean and the way in which that is an essential part of understanding your story and experience.
Well, I think it's I wasn't brought up to do this. I was brought up to probably be an investment banker in New York City. I was raised in Connecticut. I went to parochial schools. I've got seven brothers and sisters. All of them went to college. I went to college. I finished 3 years of college, and then I was working summers as a mover in between college semesters, and I ended up taking a road trip with one of these long-haul drivers, and I was seduced by the life and by the work, and I left college after the junior year and never looked back. But it wasn't a very popular decision at the time amongst the family.
Right. Yeah, we'll get to that in just a moment. In what ways of the most apparent nature are you unlike a lot of your colleagues or counterparts in this business? I mean, is it mostly the way you look or the way you talk or the way you carry yourself? What are the most significant ways in which you are, in a sense, out of step with a lot of your peers in the trucking world?
Some of it's the way I talk, although it's I have to say the trucking world out there is getting much more diverse now than it used to be. We definitely see a lot more husband and wife teams, a lot more families out there. See a lot of pets. It's a little more domestic, the life in the truck stop, now than it used to be. But still, you know, there's a lot of drivers out there that this is an occupation that they've chosen because of a lack of economic opportunities wherever they're from. And when I first started, most drivers were from rural parts of the Midwest or the South. And this was the job that they could get and the job that they could have. So I'd say one big difference is I actually chose this job, and I had lots of other options.
You talk about your first sort of encounter from afar, in a sense, with truckers and movers when you were working at a full-service gas station, Dan's Service Station in Kaskab, Connecticut. Explain to our listeners the circumstances under which you got to see movers and truckers in action, in a sense.
So there was a moving company that was right next door to the gas station. So I was 15 years old, and I'd be sitting behind the desk there at the gas station waiting for customers. And every day at 4:30, I'd see the movers come across the gas island, and they were in their moving shirts, and they were carrying their tool bags, and they were carrying their lunch boxes and their hump straps. And I could see the little white lines of dried sweat on their T-shirts. And then they'd all line up along the fence there right next to the gas station. They'd pull out their beer coolers, and they'd sit there for an hour or so after work and talk about the jobs that they'd done. And I was listening to these guys, and I was watching them, and I could see the big arms, and I could see the hard work and the sweat, and it just really looked attractive to me then, and it's attractive to me now.
I thought it was interesting, too, you describe the way in which you and your fellow gas jockeys were quite intimidated by these guys. I mean, and it's not just being scared of them, but something further. You write, "We could see the scars, smell the sweat, and translate the banter. This was tough work for tough men. Because of that, no gas jockey would have dreamed of approaching the movers, initiating a conversation, or commenting on anything said, still less to helping himself to one of those frosty Schaefer cans peeking suggestively through the ice cubes in the coolers under the tree." And on the other hand, these guys would encounter you at the drop of a hat, at their own sort of pleasure. So it was. There's a really interesting dynamic that was going on between you guys and them.
Yes, it was a lesson in hierarchy, and where the gas jockeys were there at the bottom, and I looked up to these men. I looked up to the work that they did. I looked up to the humor that they brought to their work, and I looked up to the camaraderie that they had. And when men do hard work together, there is a bond there. And this was a group of, you know, at the time when you could be a middle class manual laborer, that they had a real sense of brotherhood, and that's what attracted me to it. In addition to the work itself, I was a very hyper, very nervous kind of young man, and I wanted to release some tension, and work did that.
Right. You tell us that on your 18th birthday, you walked into the office of Callahan Brothers, this moving company, filled out an application, and were hired. We'll leave it to our listeners to read all the grisly details, but in a nutshell, describe what your first day was like with Callahan Brothers.
I was so lucky I didn't get fired. I went there on my 18th birthday because I wanted to test myself and see if I could be part of that and see if I could do the work. So that was the first thing. But I was so nervous about doing it, and I had seen these men for a couple of years, and they had seen me. So the idea of this, you know, little – I was short when I was at that age. I was the smallest kid in my class. And the idea of them, for them, of seeing this sort of smart-mouthed little gas jockey come to them and try to do their work, well, they didn't make it easy for me, and I didn't make it easy for myself. So on that first day, I fell through an attic in the sheetrock. I overheated my boss's car because I left it running with the air conditioner on. I broke a bunch of picture frames, and at the end of the day, I went in to quit, and the boss wouldn't let me.
Well, you were about to quit because you thought otherwise you'll be fired, but he was a surprisingly forgiving gentleman, and you were able to stay on.
Let's fast forward to the day that you, in a sense, washed out of college. First of all, what was going on there that that made you and college not quite a successful match?
So college, in my family, college was a given. We were all going to go, and my parents were very supportive in terms of tuition and things. But we did have to work summers and make as much money as we can. And that's how I got into the moving business was that was my summer job in between college semesters. Hmm.
So describe to our listeners how the news was greeted by your parents that you intended not to return to college for your senior year, but in fact we're going to flush all of that away and do trucking full-time.
Yes, this was not a popular decision, particularly because my father had never been to college. He wasn't able to go to college because his father died at the age of 50, and my father was about 21 or 20 years old at the time. And so he had to support his family, and the one thing that my father always wanted to do in his life and his one regret in his life was that he never did get a chance to go to college. So it was a big thing for him to have all of his children go and graduate. And so when I, after 3 years, because I wasn't a good student, I wasn't paying attention to anything I should have been paying attention to, it was sort of a double blow for him because it was hitting his ambition for his children, number one, and number two, the idea that somebody would reject an opportunity that he didn't have was very hard for him and hard for us. And we finally came around. We had a rapprochement about that, but there was a couple years there where it was very difficult.
Right. Well, and you describe in really painful fashion your father coming to you shortly after you had sort of made this announcement, and he, in a sense, presented you with a bill for the tuition they had paid thus far, the rent they felt that you owed them for the past three summers, the rent you would have to pay if you were going to live there any longer. I mean, that gives us some sense of the depth and intensity of his displeasure.
Yes, and especially for him, because he was a very amiable man. I don't think I've seen him lose his temper in more than a couple times in my whole life. And he never swore. He was well liked, and just this was the trigger for him to reject the opportunity that he didn't have.
So how confident were you that this was a life that was going to be fulfilling for you, and that you would be happy doing this? I mean, was it with utter confidence that this was the right choice, or was it a decision you were making with a bit more uncertainty than that?
Well, I was a very young idiot at the time.
So
with all the confidence of a 21-year-old, and all the accumulated wisdom that a 21-year-old has.
Good answer. We're speaking with Finn Murphy, and we're talking about his book, The Long Haul, A Trucker's Tale of Life on the Road. One of the things you tell us about as you kind of spell out what this world is like is you explain, in a sense, speaking of hierarchy, which you talked about a little earlier, the hierarchy that is out there in the world of trucking. And I think you're so right. I think you say at one point in the book that most of us who are just driving on the highways in our cars look at big trucks and we sort of lump them all together as pretty much the same thing, pretty much doing the same thing. And it's not true. And there is a distinct hierarchy out there in a couple of different respects. Describe the world of trucking for us in terms of that hierarchy and where you were in that hierarchy.
Yes, so any group of human beings get together, I think, there's an old Irish saying, if there were three Irishmen marooned on a desert island, two of them would be off in the corner talking about the third one. So any group of people has their hierarchy. And, of course, when you establish the hierarchy, then you establish yourself at the very top, regardless of what the facts of the case might be. So, yes, in trucking, so you have freight haulers. Those are the most the common ones you see. Those are hauling freight boxes. Then you've got animal transporters. You've got hazardous material haulers. You've got movers like me. And then you've got lots of specialized haulers. And all of them take different skills. And all of them are very different. And all of them are paid differently. Now, the reason the movers think that we're at the apex of the pyramid, there's two reasons for that. One of them is that we load and unload our own trucks. So we do the manual labor required for that. Another thing that we do is we interact daily with customers, with people and families that are moving. So we have to have a certain amount of skill and tact and diplomacy to make that transition for families proper and a good experience if we can do that. So, and then the money part, I think, is the most important one, because, you know, a mover at the top of the moving at the top of the industry, you know, where, like the moving I do now, I do high-end corporate relocation, so I move mostly executives, top executives. You know, a good guy like that can make, you know, over $200,000 a year, where the average wage for a freight hauler is somewhere between $36,000 and $39,000. So we can make, you know, 8 or 9 times more than a standard freight hauler. But then, of course, we have to work for it, and we have to load and unload. So that's quite different.
You say that this hierarchy between different kinds of truckers is particularly evident around the truck stop coffee counter. Explain what you mean there.
So a lot of the social structure at the truck stop is based on the kind of truck that you drive. And that's a big black long nose Peterbilt with a lot of chrome on it. Within a certain subsector of the trucking community, that would be considered the kind of guy that they would want to be. Movers are different in the sense that we don't care that much about what kind of tractor we're driving. It's more about what kind of revenue we're making. If you wanted to get sociological about it, I would say that, if you're in the lower end of the income scale as a truck driver, then what you're driving is very important. And if you're at the higher end of the income scale, it's how much you're making is the standard.
I know you're a fan of Terry Gross and Fresh Air, and if you were talking to Terry Gross, she would ask you to read something from your book. Do you typically do that in your interviews?
Sure, I'd be happy to.
The only thing is, I have a particular passage in mind that I was going to read, but I think it would be so much better if we heard it in your voice. Do you mind if I tell you what I want you to read? Is that okay?
Oh, I'd love to do that.
Okay.
Thanks. Then I'll have to go searching through it, yeah.
Right, okay. What I would really like to have you read for our listeners is on page 63. It's from the chapter called Hammer Down, and it's from the second section of the book called The Power Lane. And this is a passage in the book in which you kind of describe what life is like at its best when you are out on the open road driving a truck. I was thinking of you starting at the last paragraph on 63 and finishing up at the top of 64, if you don't mind.
Oh, I'm so happy that you picked out that passage. I call that Kerouacian yawp.
All right, go for it. So, again, this is going to be Finn Murphy reading from his book, The Long Haul, A Trucker's Tales of Life on the Road. Take it away.
Coming into Metro New York from points west or south has always supercharged me. But doing it in a big truck is pure adrenaline. This is the closest I ever come to feeling the true essence of life on the road. I've got a hard, muscled body, a big, comfortable new tractor hauling a 53-foot moving trailer, grooving with my killer sound system, a 30-ounce Dr. Cola in the holder. There's the whistle of the supercharger as I shift into 13th gear. the whoosh of the air dryer, my mouth slightly sour, arms shaking from the pounding of the wheel, making money, setting my own schedule, the Manhattan skyline on my right, flying fast and furious on my way up to home plate in Connecticut. I'm inside 60 miles of tremendously satisfying task saturation, what I call threading the needle. Me and the monster truck are hurtling through 16 lanes of the most intense, dangerous, and exhilarating piece of roadway ever devised by man. And I'm the king of it all, with my truck, my tunes, and my big independence. All the stories, the longings, the dreams, the books, the movies, the songs, the great American dream of chucking it all and hitting the road. Well, right at this moment, I am the song.
Great passage from your book, The Long Haul. It's interesting. We read that, and especially as we hear you read it, there's probably a bunch of us who are ready to tender our resignation from whatever we're doing and trading it all away for the life that you just described. But in the interest of full disclosure, you go right on in the next paragraph to say these moments don't last long. Exhilaration will step aside and make room for the other reality that's always pushing to get in. So what is the proportion between those marvelous moments you were just describing and the more mundane aspects of it, and also those moments that are downright nightmarish? I mean, how does it all sort of add up to be a life that you want to have?
That's the journey, Greg. But don't quit your job right now. Really, don't. That's part of the journey that is throughout this, that is sort of runs through the book, is these moments of exhilaration versus these moments of disorientation. Because, you know, a long-haul trucker, he swims in this ocean of disorientation. I never know where my stuff is. I never know if I paid my taxes. Never know where my clean clothes are. I could be underneath the truck in a snowstorm putting on chains up in the Rocky Mountains. And these are not special romantic moments. At 8 o'clock at night after loading the truck all day and I'm moving some family and, you know, the husband or the wife is going crazy at me because somebody dropped Aunt Tilly's antique vanity or something. That's not a romantic moment. Leaving, you know, New York or leaving New Jersey on my way to San Diego, and I've got 4.5 days of driving ahead of me through the ice and snow and slush, that's not romantic either. Mm-hmm. Working with people who, you know, who I pick up along the way, people in my crew who, you know, may not be working right or properly or might be lazy, and that's not romantic. Mm-hmm. On the other hand, you know, driving into New Mexico on Interstate 10, driving west and just watching that red desert come up or watching the sun go down or the eastern Cascades of Washington, the eastern Washington, you're going through all these vineyards and then you see the Cascades come up. I mean, those are magical moments. Hmm. And when you've actually moved a family and done the transition the way that it should be done and they're all very happy and you shake hands and drive away and I toot the air horn, that's a nice moment.
That reminds me that one predominant theme in the book, a recurrent theme, are really the two words, no claim. That in many cases, one of these moving jobs will end with, best of all, no claim, no claim. Explain to our listeners what the importance of those two simple words in the business that you're in.
Damage claims, yes. Movers don't like to get them, they don't like to deal with them, and they certainly don't like to pay them. And so for me, so I've got a $1,600 deductible for every move that I do, and that's why I'm going to be careful with people's things. It's because I have to pay if I damage it. And so we have to be very careful that when, if something is damaged, that it's actually the movers that did it. And there's, you know, there's a subset of people out there that think that there's a nameless insurance company who's going to, you know, pay to get your coffee table refinished. And, you know, I don't want to be paying for that out of my deductible, especially if I've done a good job. Hmm. And there's an army of, so here's an interesting point. So most moving companies, even though the general view of the public is, you know, is a pretty dismal view about movers, and I think a lot of that's wrapped up into the insecurity of relocating in general.
Right.
I just lost my point there. Never mind.
One of the things that's clear in your book is that you get to see the world and see our country and see people's lives from a particular perspective that a lot of the rest of us do not. And so your book is just full of these sort of intriguing insights, and you also have this charming way of sharing them that makes you not seem like a know-it-all, but just as someone who's seen a lot of things that the rest of us see, or you've seen things but you can understand them from the point of view of someone who's a mover. For instance, one of the things you say is when you're in the business of moving people is you get to see how people really live. You say the intimacy is immediate and merciless. Explain that, how a mover gets to see how people really live instead of the way they want other people to think they live. I mean, what are the kinds of things you see that end up giving you that kind of insight?
So the kind of moving that I do now, the full service move, so the shipper is what they call the customer in the moving business. My shippers won't really do anything. The more or less typical one was last summer when I was moving a guy to Vancouver from Connecticut. And I went in and met the family. They were having breakfast, and he shook our hands. And then he got up, and the family got up, and they went into a limousine and took it to the airport to Vancouver. And we cleaned up the breakfast dishes and started packing the house. So we see everything when we're packing a house up. We see what's in the back of the file cabinet down on the bottom. We see what's down in the basement. It's moving is a full-scale life inspection for us. And I like to think that I can take a lesson from that in terms of the kind of stuff that I have and whether the belongings that I own, whether who's the master, who's ruling the roost here. Is it my stuff that's dictating what happens in my life, or is it my life that's dictating what's happening in my life?
Hmm.
And a lot of these people have a lot of stuff, and it really, frankly, it drives a lot of people crazy having all these houses, all this stuff.
Right. You say that one repeated source of frustration both for you and for a lot of your clients is when people will move to Florida and will move all kinds of stuff that they absolutely do not need. And once they see it all sort of plopped in their garage or whatever, they can't believe they did it. And it's interesting, as you describe this phenomenon, you also talk about how for you also that is a real painful sort of experience, because I if I remember correctly, you kind of talk about how it makes you feel like a lot of the work you do, in a sense, is pointless. I mean, moving stuff that people don't need and people don't need to have moved, but have it moved anyway. Describe what I'm talking about here.
Yes. So in this culture, people pay a lot of attention to accumulation. I don't want to sound judgmental about that. It's just the fact that's where the emphasis is, and the getting rid of accumulated stuff is not nearly as important. In fact, normally, getting rid of people's personal possessions it happens to the heirs of whoever has all of this stuff who end up getting rid of it, and that's where. Somebody like me, I have sort of a Zen Buddhist view about people's belongings, which is that, you know, it's all going to be thrown away. And in many cases, I'm the guy who actually does throw it away. So when people bring stuff, the example you're talking about, when people bring stuff down to Florida and then in the Florida sunshine, they don't like the stuff that they have anymore, and then they start throwing it away. It makes me feel a little bit like it's pointless, told this stuff, I'm paid to be careful with this stuff, and then when they see it in the Florida sunshine, then they want me to throw it away. And I'm thinking about, what am I doing?
Right. It's as though you are, in a sense, a party to a crime. Not quite a crime, but it's as though you are a part of the process of enabling people to hold on to things that they should be discarding one way or another. In fact, you say at one point, movers are there at the beginning point of accumulation and all the points to the bitter end. So in a sense, you're in an especially good position to sort of see just how much we seem to gravitate towards our things and refuse to let them go.
And it runs on a bell curve, Greg. So you can almost tell by the age of somebody how much stuff they're going to have. So at the beginning point of accumulation, once somebody forms a family, then it starts. Then the curve starts moving up. And then if they're successful, then they'll start accumulating more things. And if they're really successful, they'll start accumulating houses and all sorts of other things. And then sort of hit 50, and then it starts to go down the other way. And I've done more than 3,000 moves. So to me, it just looks like a continuum. So when I see somebody stuck in that, 45-year-old accumulation phase, it doesn't look like an individual to me. It looks like the top end of a continuum. And it doesn't make sense to me because I already know 20 years from now that their kids, who are now, 9 or 10 years old, are going to be calling the movers to put it all into the dumpster.
We're speaking with Finn Murphy and talking about his book called The Long Haul, A Trucker's Tales of Life on the Road. For more than three decades, Finn Murphy has been a long-haul trucker and has literally covered well more than a million miles across the country. Explain to our listeners the logistics by which these kind of transactions typically occur, and in particular, sort of the marvelous challenge that is involved in making all of this work in terms of getting the truck packed just so, and also the intricate arrangements that are important in order for this to be as profitable as possible.
Well, one of the things that I think is devalued in terms of manual labor is there's an intellectual scope to this that people don't always see. So, for example, when I pull up into somebody's house, and if I get the truck into the driveway, which is a whole other thing, that's why my CB handle is U-turn, because I'm always putting the truck in a place where a truck isn't designed to go. So assuming I get close to the house, then I have to completely prep the house so that nothing gets banged or dented inside. And then we have to pack up all the cartons, and then we have to cover all the furniture with moving pads, and then we have to put it in the truck so it all fits, and so it doesn't get damaged. And we have to build these huge walls in the truck. We call them tiers. And those, a moving van might have 25, 30 tiers in it that I'm building right up to the ceiling. So I have to be careful. It's like a Rubik's Cube or a Tetris game. And it's very intellectually challenging. And it's also physically challenging. And that makes for a great combination. It's like building a stone wall or building your own house or something like that, where you get this magical combination of manual labor and intellectual effort, and you've got something that you can see at the end of it. And then, of course, we get to the other end, and then we tear it all down and move on to the next job.
Right. And talk for a moment about the tricky matter of having the jobs, in a sense, lined up in such a way that you're not going to be driving thousands of miles with an empty truck. I mean, that's its own sort of Tetris challenge.
Yes. So sometimes I'll have more than one load on the truck. So, but we're gonna roll when we're full. So I get paid by the weight. So I'm gonna have my truck full. And then so there's a dispatcher who works for my van line who organizes these things, and then I'm the one who has to execute it. But I never know where I'm going. So, I mean, I know where I'm going, in the next week or so. But once I've delivered a load to Tampa, I mean, I might be going back to Colorado. I might be going to Caribou, Maine. I might be going to San Diego. I've got no clue from one week to the next where I'm going, which makes for a certain
make a fervent case for the use of maps versus drivers being too dependent on GPS. And of course, this is one of a number of ways in which the business you're in has changed since you started in this business more than 30 years ago. But it sounds like you are not that big a fan of GPS systems and are more of a believer in old-fashioned maps. Is that right?
Yes. I'm not sure if that makes me a geezer or a Luddite or not quite sure what that makes me. I'll tell you what the safety department says in the company that I work for. They say that since people have gone to navigation systems, that truckers get lost about three times more often than they used to. And I think that's because when you have an atlas, I've got the Rand McNally Truckers Road Atlas 2017, which costs $69 with the laminated pages, and that really is the Bible that I use. So when I'm going anywhere, I internalize where I'm going. I already know where I'm turning before I turn. I already know generally where I'm going. And when you use these nav systems, you know, first thing is a lot of times you don't see the whole picture on the little screen, and then, you know, you're dependent on the voice to tell you turn right, turn left. A lot of these systems don't have capacity for low bridges. A lot of them don't distinguish highways and parkways and other things like that. I mean, you can really end up in a place you don't want to be by depending too much on that. Hmm.
One of the things you talk about is that as you have proceeded through your career towards the work you're doing now, which involves high-end moving of, you know, executives, for instance, you talk about how that has made a big difference in terms of who can work for you, who you hire out there on the road to assist you in some of the heavy lifting and so on, and that at this point in time, you have to be much more particular. Say a word about this challenging aspect of what you do and of how those challenges, the nature of those challenges has changed over the course of time.
Yeah, so if we look at it from the side of the person who's moving, which is what I'm trying to do all the time, and if I can walk around in their shoes for a little bit, it certainly makes me understand things a little bit better. And what you have here is you have a group of strangers driving up to your house, taking away everything that's near and dear to you. And, you know, you might have a security system in your house. You might lock your door every day. You might change your garage code every month. You might carry an umbrella. And all of a sudden, all of that is suspended immediately, and these group of strangers are coming in, and they're carrying everything out and putting it into a truck. And who are these people? You've got no idea. And who am I? I mean, they've got no idea. So one of the first things that we try to do when we're moving is, in, you know, the first 5 or 10 minutes is to sort of smooth things over and make it look, I mean, make it look, there's a Freudian, it's like, make it look like we're not a bunch of animals. So that people are confident that, you know, we're going to take care of their things and they're going to get everything that they shipped, they're going to get it back at the other end. And that's, it's difficult because the crews that I hire, these folks, almost all of them are men. There's a few women in this business, but not many. They have to have background checks now, and I have this little black book which has these professional on-call movers all over the country, and they have a thing called a hire right card which shows that they've had a background check and it's passed, and their names need to be on file with my van line. And a lot of these, go ahead.
You also tell us that in this latter point of your career, one thing that has changed from the early days is that you don't see the drinking and driving and moving that you once did. Can you explain why that's changed?
Yes. In fact, the whole trucking society has definitely gotten a lot better. What you see now, what you never used to see, you see a lot of husband and wife teams now. It's definitely more domesticized. You see more women around in the trucking world in general, not so much in the moving world, but in the trucking world, there's a lot more women around. A lot of people have pets, a lot of little dogs and cats in the living in the cabs. And, you know, frankly, when you have more women around, everybody seems to behave just a little bit better. So that's been a nice change. And the other thing is, you know, mandatory drug testing. So I get tested on a regular basis, sort of a random basis. According to federal laws, your safety department, if your number comes up, then you have 2 hours to go get a urinalysis test for drugs and alcohol.
Hmm.
And that has cleaned up the trucking business in a way that nobody could have foreseen.
One of the things you tell us that is a big surprise is that in the world of trucking, one does not see all that much bigotry, racial bigotry. Explain why you think that is.
I think it's because the nature of the work, regardless of whatever trucking you do, whether you're hauling freight or being a mover or transporting animals or whatever that is. Sorry, I'm going to stop there. Start all over again.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry. What was the question again? Just real quick, Greg. Sorry.
Sure. I'll restate the question. One of the things that was a surprising moment in the book is when you said that there's really, in this world, not all that much bigotry. And I think a lot of people might be surprised to hear that. Explain why you think there is so little racial bigotry in this particular world.
Well, first thing I'd say is that's my particular opinion. There might be other ideas out there about that. What I can say about the moving business is that the work is held in such low esteem by the general public and you know, by the nature of its work itself. You know, this is just brute manual labor, and nobody wants to do it. So in the industry, pretty much anyone who's willing to do this kind of work, they're accepted on their ability. So I would almost call it a meritocracy. If you can spend 12 hours moving furniture all day long, big, heavy stuff, loading trucks, then that automatically accepts you into the fraternity.
Hmm.
And because, so it's the work in the terms of the skill that it takes and in terms of the, you know, just brute force that it takes. And then the fact that nobody else understands or appreciates it.
Hmm.
So we don't have time for, you know, he's a Mexican or he's an Irishman or he's a black man. It's not relevant to getting the day's work done.
Hmm. One really poignant moment in the book is when you talk about some of the places to which you've driven and where you will see all kinds of pawn shops along with secondhand car dealers and often close to military bases and military communities. And when you look at these pawn shops, you say that it really gives you pause. Describe to our listeners sort of the grim, sad reality that is, in a sense, behind the facade of these pawn shops and businesses like that.
Yes, I think what I say is that a pawn shop is an indicator of flawed financial planning, or something to that effect. And I guess, to be really serious here for a minute, one of the things that I've seen change over the years was this group of working men who I first became enamored with back when I first started as being a mover. This was a middle class job. You know, these guys could own their own homes. These guys would go home after work and they'd have families. And even though they didn't make a lot of money, they could have a sort of a nice life. And nowadays, a day laborer working in this kind of work, things like home ownership and that, you know, American middle that seemed to be sort of a social compact, I just don't see it anymore. I don't know what happened. I don't know anything really about any of it, except that for a large portion of the people that I work with, that dream is gone. And they don't make the kind of money that, in terms of purchasing power, than what they made a generation ago.
Hmm.
And so therefore, that's where you have the proliferation of pawn shops and secondhand things and all of that kind of stuff. It's because people aren't making it economically that you have these things.
Right. You write, a pawn shop is a ruthless indicator of flawed financial planning.
when you encounter a galaxy of pawn shops like in Fayetteville, Arkansas, you don't need to be Lord Keynes to figure out what's going on. How interesting what you've seen in your life, because you, of course, have seen plenty of neighborhoods like that, and yet your world has also taken you into the worlds of wealthy people as well. In a sense, you've seen our country from top to bottom.
This is the seat I get, and this is why it's choice worthy work, and this is why I'm 59 years old and still doing it. I get to sit in between the both extremes of the spectrum of American life, and hopefully I can personally take a message from that and design my own life in a way that is somewhere closer to a measured middle, is what I would say.
A last question. You take a hiatus away from this work after a really frustrating disappointment where you're just kind of disillusioned with the whole system, and then you return to this life. And the events that prompt you to return to this life, you do not really spell out for us, except we have a sense that something went pretty wrong in your life. And I'm not going to try to cajole you to tell us more than you choose to tell us in the book. But, I mean, it's clear that something very painful and wrenching happened in your life, and your answer to that was to return to this life. I wonder if you could just say a very general word about what it has felt like to come in and out of this particular world or this particular line of work, and in particular what it has felt like in this most recent chapter.
Okay, but you don't need to cajole me into the missing 20 years. But I will talk about that just a little bit. I wasn't keeping it a secret or anything. It doesn't fit with the narrative of what the book is about. So that's why I really didn't go into it. Maybe that'll be book two, Greg. here's what I can say. I was married for 25 years. I was living in the East Coast. My marriage broke up. I moved out west. And I think the takeaway point that's important here is when we first started this conversation a little while ago, I said that I had chosen this job, whereas many drivers, this is the only economic opportunity that they have, and therefore we have a different approach to how we look at it. So when I started this, I chose it. And then when I was cast adrift, when I cast myself adrift and was living out west, and I had no job and no friends, and the whole life that I had before was gone, I became one of those other guys.
Hmm.
I didn't feel like I had a choice. I didn't feel like I had any economic opportunity. So I went back on the road because I felt like I had no other choice.
Hmm. And did that change then very much what the experience was like to do this work under those kind of circumstances?
It did. It pulled me out of the funk, actually. It looked like a bad decision at the time, or it was almost no decision at the time. But what I had brought with me was a certain sense of disappointment and a certain sense of failure that I actually translated into becoming a better mover and a better person. So I could now approach the job of moving families and working through navigating a transition of a family with so much more compassion and understanding than I had brought when I was a very young idiot.
Well, we appreciate the candor and the level of insight in all of the stories that you tell about the various people you encounter and about what this life has been like over all these years. The book, again, is The Long Haul, A Trucker's Tales of Life on the Road, published by W.W. Norton & Company, and the author, Finn Murphy. Finn Murphy, congratulations on this wonderful first book. We hope that more will be coming from you. And in the meantime, happy trails, and thank you for being part of the morning show.
Thank you so much, Greg. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
And it's a minute before 9 o'clock here on WGTD. Tomorrow on the morning show, we are going to be celebrating the 30th anniversary of the Racine Symphony Lakeside Pops concerts. We'll be talking to their